February 25th, 1970, Tano Yukon Historical Society meeting in the Pioneer Hall, Fairbanks, Alaska. Our guest this evening is Heini Karsten, pioneer miner from the Central District.
Mother was born in Germany in 1870. I have to think a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, 1874, I believe. No, she was born in Germany in 1867. And my father was born in 1868. And they came, my father came first to America in 1874. And my mother came in 1879. And she settled in Council Bluffs, Iowa. And my father settled in Clinton, Iowa. I was born in Clinton, Iowa, in the middle of the Mississippi River on Beaver Island in 1893.
Well, that's very interesting. How long did you live in the States, and when did you come to Alaska?
I was born in 1893, and I came to Washington, Leavenworth, Washington, in 1903.
You were just a child then.
I was 10 years old.
And did you come to Alaska in 1903 then, or?
No, I came to Alaska in 1923.
And what did you do in the state of Washington?
Oh, I sawmilled most of the time there, and I worked in the woods in the winter, and sawmill in the summer.
Mm-hmm. Why did you come to Alaska?
Well, in 1908, I wanted to come to Alaska. And my father thought I was too young. I was 15 years old then. And he said, you better wait a couple of years. So I put it off until the next year. And then the next fall, my dad got drowned in the Columbia River and left the whole family to me. So I stayed and supported the family and raised them all and schooled them. And in the spring of 23, I came to Alaska.
How many were there in your family?
There was 10 of us children and my mother.
Why did you come to Alaska?
Well, I always had the hankering to come to Alaska. I always did.
Did you intend to mine when you came to Alaska?
That was problematical, you know. I don't know what I was going to do, but I knew I could work as good as any man, so I just figured I was going to come to Alaska.
And where
1908.
Where did you go then?
I came direct to Fairbanks.
Uh-huh. And by way of Valdez?
No, I came to Seward on the boat and then took the train to Nenana. And we changed cars in Nenana. It was narrow gauge from there to Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And I came to Fairbanks on the 26th of March.
In 1923. Mm-hmm. What was your first job in the interior?
First job I got was up on the salt shed for Jimmy Stewart. And he was just a kind of ground sluicing, but then I finally took over a shovel and dragline combined, and I operated that summer. That is, I was one of the operators.
Mm-hmm. And who else did you work with in the interior before you went on your own?
Well, I worked there for Stewart until the 1st of October, around the 1st of October. Then we came down the river, and Dinhart, he was interested with Stewart, and he said, well, I had a little money, you see, and I gave it to the office. And every once in a while, I'd send my mother a $20 traveler's check, and he says, that's right, he says, you get it all in a lump, and then you can do something with it. But that fall, it cost me $200 to get my summer's wages. I didn't draw anything all summer. Mm-hmm. So after I got my money, I went down to Anchorage and hacked ties for the Alaska Railroad. I'm ahead of my story there a little. Before I went down there, the cook and I walked back up on the Salcha, and we staked two claims. And we bought one, and took a lease on two claims on No Grub Creek. And then we came back and went on down to earn money to operate the thing. And we worked there from the fall of 23 till August the 18th, 26. And then I came back to the interior, and I've been here ever since.
Mm-hmm. Have you been... Now, when were you married?
I was married in 40. 1940.
1940,
12th of June, 1940.
Well, then from about 1926 until the present time, have you been on your own all this time? Or
most of the time on my own, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm.
And you've done your own prospect work? And,
yes.
What creeks have you been on, principally?
Well, the first pace streak I found was on Ketchum Creek. That's near Circle Springs. And then the next one I found was in, Ketchum Creek, that was in 35. When I found that, and then I went over on the head of the Salcha, and I found a pay streak there on Glacier Creek. That was in 44. And then I came back, and I discovered the 22nd of July, I believe it was. Yes, 66, when I found Lower Eagle.
And all during this period, those are the areas that you've mined?
Oh, no, I've mined all around mm-hmm. Deadwood, Ketchum, and I first went over in 33 to Porcupine Creek. At Porcupine Creek mm-hmm. and Mammoth make Crooked, mm-hmm. you see. And I went. We went mining up on Porcupine there, the Dutch kid, Paul Menzel, and Dick Thorson, and myself. That was the spring of 33. We built a ditch and hydraulic there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you find mining profitable in the 20s and then in the 30s?
Oh, yes.
It was
yes.
profitable.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I was on the Porcupine from until the fall of 44, or 34. And from the first in 33 until 34, we took out $225,000 out of the Porcupine.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money.
Yes, that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm.
What type of equipment were you using?
Hydraulic.
Hydraulic.
Hydraulic. Uh-huh.
All hydraulicing, no dredges or.
No, no, all hydraulic, mm-hmm. and we had an old 30 best without any dozer on it.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And everything was hydraulic there. Mm-hmm. And then I left there and I went on Ketchum Creek, and I found a pay streak there. And then I had a lease on that, and I took in Tony Zimmerman there, and he wound up with it eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I staked a little ground on Deadwood, and I sniped on Deadwood. That's mining in a mm-hmm. short way. It's mm-hmm. a small way, you know. Well, let's see. I had that for 3 or 4 years, and I sold it. And I went over on Bottom Dollar, and I lost everything I had there on Bottom Dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And I had worked a little bit on Portage Creek for mm-hmm. Bergstrom and Savage, mm-hmm. and I knew what was there. So I don't remember what year it was I went on there. But anyway, I took a hold of Portage Creek, mm-hmm. and I mined there, and I paid for all of my equipment and all of my pipe and everything I own. I bought it right off what I took out of Portage Creek.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that all hydraulic there, too?
No, no, that was mostly equipment.
I see.
Cats and mm-hmm. dozers, you know, mm-hmm. and drag line mm-hmm. and overhead boxes. Mm-hmm. And I finally made a washing plant there with a trommel, mm-hmm. and I bailed into that, and that's when I made my best money, mm-hmm. was operating alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, on these prospects, most of them that you've worked, the ones that you've made a lot of money on, are those that you found yourself, or
you prospected them
and found them.
That's right.
Well, right offhand, I would say there are not too many people that are still in the mining game that started mining in the 1920s and still mining.
Not very many. No. I was one of the lucky ones in Alaska because The papers will show you that there's one man out of every 200,000 that come to Alaska has found anything worthwhile, and I have found three. So that's a lot of digging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you mined, you told us about, was it bottom dollar that, that was your bottom dollar?
That was the bottom dollar.
Now you've told us of others that were profitable. Now, some of these streams you must remember because they were extremely hard to mine. For instance, Ketchum Creek has got a lot of rock.
A lot of rock on Ketchum, but it's easier to mine than Portage Creek. Portage Creek is granite bedrock, and it's really hard to mine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how about the Upper Salcha?
The Upper Salcha is still there.
Oh, it's still there.
It's too hard to get into. It's still there.
It's the transportation of equipment and so
forth.
Right.
That's right. That's for somebody else with lots of money to mine.
Now, one of the things you're speaking about mining, you went from hydraulics, where you'd have to be a civil engineer, I presume, and possibly more than that in the matter of hydraulics. And you were over on Portage Creek, where you had heavy equipment.
That's right.
And they tell me you were a very successful mechanic, that there was really wasn't anything you couldn't repair.
That's right. Anything at all.
Yeah, I've heard.
I'll tell you one thing I did do when I was in Fairbanks here before I went over the Circle Camp. I built the first dozer that was ever in the interior of Alaska to plow out snow. Mm-hmm. The road commission never owned a dozer at that time. And I built the first dozer.
Mm-hmm.
Successful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I plowed my way all the way up to Van Curler's Bar and back down again.
With
the 30 best, just the 30 best. That's a 5-ton machine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now you lived in these various places. Do you always return, or did you always return to Fairbanks, or did you remain out on the creeks all winter in some of these places?
No, I stayed out in the creeks
all the time.
Uh-huh.
Now you've lived in the Central District apparently for a long time.
Yes, I've lived in Central since 1940.
Mm-hmm. You have your home there in Central?
Yes, I have 5 acres of ground in Central, and a pretty nice home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, since 1923, I guess, when you got here, you've observed many changes, not only in the Fairbanks area, but in Alaska, and of course in mining. Could you tell us about some of these particular changes? Let's take transportation as an example. What were your big problems in transportation initially?
Well, the big problems in the early days, it was with horses. And deep snow, you know, would stop you and the likes of that. There's a minute, I could just talk all night long.
Us about it.
Yeah, I think I have some other things I want to tell you about.
Okay, real fine.
More interesting than
we'd like to hear them.
Than the transportation.
We'd like to hear them.
Well, I'll tell you, on Portage Creek, I got off from bottom dollar. I just lived on moose meat and potatoes that winter because we lost our bottom dollar all right. And I got a hold of Portage Creek, and the moment I got a hold of it, I started to make a little money.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there, and I had men hired, and I had men steal from me. I remember one fellow, he got away with $4,000 out of the box from me. And I never caught him, of course, but I was robbed twice there. And but I finally built a trommel, and that's a revolving screen, 4-foot screen and 18 feet long. And I had the water pressure in there from a pump, you know. And I bailed in with a drag line. Mm-hmm. I bailed into a hopper.
Mm-hmm.
And the first year, I bulldozed the tailings away from the trommel. And after that, I bought a stacker, a 32-foot stacker, and I stacked it. And every year, I laid away a little money, And I finally wound up at owning the drag line, and I owned three cats. And I had over a mile of hydraulic pipe with all kinds of fittings. And everything was paid for, you mm-hmm. see. I was wise enough to pay for it all.
Mm-hmm.
So I leased it to Walter Roman for a couple of summers. And I thought I was getting old, you know, and couldn't work anymore. But I found out that Walter, he didn't make anything either. Mm-hmm. And so it's been, I still have the lease on Portage Creek, but there's some people from Florida coming up this summer that's supposed to work it. But they will make a little money if they work it right. But anyway, I went over on Eagle Creek. I used to go over Eagle, and going down, I'd always look at that lower ground, and I always wanted to get a lease on it. And finally, the state took it over, and they held it as a recreation center for the tourists for mm-hmm. a couple of years, and they found out there were too many mosquitoes for the mm-hmm. tourists, so they threw it open for relocation. And my wife and I, we got married, and this was in 66, and we got married, and while we were in town, we heard there was a couple of parties going over there and stake Lower Eagle. So we went back to Central, and before the road opened up, we went over the snowdrifts mm-hmm. with a six cap. And mm-hmm. We had 22 and 24 feet of snow that we went over. This was my wife's honeymoon ride, yeah, you see, yeah. on the RD6. So I was just confident that I could find the pay there. Mm-hmm. So I moved the two houses over there, and the two cats, and the drag line. And when it started to thaw, I started to sink in holes and built a road on up the creek. Well, I sunk seven holes with a dozer and the blade. And then I said to my wife, I said, well, I'm going to sink a hole right where I always said it was. Mm-hmm. And by golly, I landed right smack dab on the pay.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you show them your pay, some of it?
Well, I'm a little sorry I didn't bring the nuggets with me. We have a bunch of nuggets at the house. If I'd known it was going to be this way, I'd have brought them along. But this is the largest one that we found last summer, and we just scratched a little of the bedrock. And ever since 66, I've been preparing to, I wanted to be sure, you know, that it was there. So I really have it. I really have a lot of money, I will say that. I don't know, it's pretty hard to tell you in the ground, you know, but I do know I have a lot of money there. Because Clarence Berry, he joins me on the upper end, and 2 miles of ground produced $11 million to Clarence Berry. That is under the present price of gold. So I joined him at the lower end, and I found the pay over on the right limit, and I prospected. I got 97,500 feet practically ready to go through the boxes, and there's money on the whole thing. I'll gamble there's nothing under $200,000 in this here block of ground that I have stripped off. Yes. So how many millions is in the ground, I can't say. But I know I have more ground than Clarence Berry had. He had 2 miles, and I have 2 3/4 miles staked now.
How much overburden do you have?
It's 25 feet to bedrock.
I see. And hydraulic or all dragline?
Well, I'm gonna hydraulic. I've been dragline, yeah, but I'm gonna hydraulic. I'll gamble I have as much money in the ground as Clarence Berry took out. That's safe to say.
Well, you're one of the few that's been able to find it.
How's that?
You're one of the few that's been able to find it. And
well, there's been between 300 and 400 men looking for this pastry. And Frank Miller, he was at Miller House, and he's telling me, he says, I can tell you right where that pay is. I says, well, I'll be glad to hear. So he says, it's in the back of the cabin. There's a certain cabin up there. And he says, I know a man that sunk a hole there, and he found it good pay there. So I said, well, I believe it's under the right limit. That's where I believe it is. And this was on the left limit. So he said, oh, you're just wasting your time. He says, if you sink a hole on the right limit, you're wasting your time. I said, I'm going to try it. So we went over there, and that's where I found it, right under the right limit, the extreme right limit, 25 foot deep. Yeah. But then, to top it all off, I must tell you, this is too good to keep. After I went back to Frank Miller and he heard that I found the pay under the right limit, he says, "Didn't I tell you that that pay was under the right limit?" I said, "No, you didn't." Yeah, he swore up and down, he told me. It was under the right limit.
Oh, this one here,
thank you.
Well, you've told us some about mining and the equipment you've used, and surely you must have had many hardships in your career as a miner and prospector.
Yes, I have. I have.
I'm wondering if some of them would be of interest.
Well, I'll spiel off one time I almost froze to death. Charlie Rogers and myself, we were coming from the head of the Salcher, and down we hit the South Fork of the Birch, and it was all glacier. And it's about 30 miles long, the South Fork of the Birch, and there's all just glare ice, the full length. As a rule, we hit a lot of water, but this time there wasn't any water. And he had five dogs, and I stripped down because it seemed kind of warm in this Box Canyon. Mm-hmm. And I hot-footed on ahead of him, and I got so far ahead that no chance to catch him anymore. So when I hit the birch, that was 30 miles I hiked that day, but I sprinted along, you know, sprint. And by golly, I walked about a quarter of a mile up the birch, and I noticed it was really cold, and I hadn't left my parkie, my mukluks, and all of my warm clothes. I left it on the sled. And so I walked this quarter of a mile up, and I decided I'd better turn around. I was getting pretty cold, and I didn't know how cold it really was, but there was a wind hitting me in the face. So I hiked back to the South Fork, mouth of the South Fork, and I stuck around there and hopped it around like that, you know, and kept myself as warm as I could. And so I got to thinking, well, Charlie may be able to way back there for all I know. And I said, 5 miles? I can surely hike 5 miles. And I had snowshoes, too. So I whirled around the way I went up the birch. And I got awful cold, I know that, but an old Charlie in sight. And by golly, I hot-footed until about around 4 miles, or a little better than 4 miles, and I could see the cabin. They would call it John Keggy's cabin, which is on Buckley Bar. And I was getting pretty stiff then already. So I kept on pushing, you know, and I knew I had to do that because if I'd sit down, I'd go to sleep. So I just kept on pushing, and before I got to the cabin, I'd like that. And like that, my legs got so stiff that I was almost frozen. And I managed to hit the door, and old John Keggy had a boiling hot fire going. And he opened the cabin, and I just staggered in. And I was 2 hours over that red-hot stove before I could even speak to him. And it was quite a while after that before Charlie Rogers ever came. And anyway, I was so near frozen, I lost all of the hide off my hands, and fingernails are gone, and I lost both big toenails, and one toe next to my big toe on my right foot, I lost that. And my legs were all frozen, and my ears and everything frozen, you know. So that was the nearest I ever come to dying. I just had to push my legs. I knew if I'd stop, I would be done. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the nearest I ever came to be frozen to death.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the mining game and the length of time you've been in Alaska, you must have met many tough men in your day.
Yes, I have.
I'm wondering if you could tell us about some of them.
I wish to.
I'll tell you where I got that question. I got it from Don Draper.
Oh, yeah. I know Don.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I... Well, it's... pretty hard to come right off and say it. I always think back at myself, you know, and it's pretty hard to find some men that are as good as I was.
Yeah.
Because I weighed 200 pounds, and I stood 5'11¼", and I've always weighed 200 pounds. And no trouble for me to throw a quarter of moose on my back and go across Niggerhead Flats with it. No trouble at all. Gus Haig, he was the man that found the gold on Caribou Creek. And he come down to the mouth of the Caribou one time, and I killed a moose about 2 miles across out of Niggerhead Flat there, big bull. And I just come in this cabin with a quarter of moose on my back, and he was what they call a singing Swede. He says, "What in the world are you doing there?" And I already had a quarter of moose there, and I had to pack the rest out. But a quarter of moose was nothing for me to pack, I will say that.
Well, yeah. That's what Don told me. He said he yeah. thought that you were probably the toughest and most skookum man that he'd run across in the North.
Well, you can ask Bill Stroker mm-hmm. or Eddie Stroker. Mm-hmm. They know me. I used to exercise a lot. I exercised morning and night because my dad, you know, he left me when I was 16 years old, and I didn't dare spend a nickel out of the way, so I built myself a gymnasium, and I developed myself to be one of the strongest men in the West there. At Leavenworth, Washington, there was 500 men there. There wasn't a one of them that could hold a candle with me. And freighting out of Fairbanks here, I never would use a board or anything to put drums on my wagon. I'd pick them off the ground and set them up on my wagon, 475 pounds, believe it or not. I did that. Yeah. So moose was nothing for me to pack. Mm-hmm. I remember my wife, she there at Central, I was cutting wood for winter, and she went out and back. She says, "I may get a moose back here." And I said, "Yes, you may." And by golly, she did. She killed the moose. And of course, she come over and she says, "You got to get yourself ready and dress him out and pack him in." Johnny Palm, I don't know if any of you folks know Johnny Palm or not. Hey. You know Johnny Palm?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was the mailman.
Mm-hmm.
And he got some of this moose. And I packed it out quarter at a time through the Niggerhead Flats. Yeah.
And, now, did you ever make any prospecting trips so you took a pack on your back and went into the woods and spent the entire summer there?
No.
Or a long period of time?
I spent about 30 days in the head of the Salcha one time.
Mm-hmm.
I went, we flew over there with a plane and couldn't land, so we landed at Woodchopper. And I took an 80-pound pack on my back, and it was 35 miles across mm-hmm. there to the head of the wood, or head of Caribou, mm-hmm. or Glacier Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And an old fellow there by the name of John May. We reached there at 9 o'clock in the morning, and he was still in bed. I remember
mm-hmm.
that. Anyway, we made it in 13 hours from Woodchopper, 35 miles. I was much younger then than I am now.
Well, that's about 4 miles an hour, approximately,
yeah.
with a pack.
Yeah.
Gracious. Don tells me that you are quite a keen observer of wildlife.
Yes, I am. When I hit Fairbanks here and the Circle Camp, the estimate was 10,000 or 10 million caribou.
Mm-hmm.
And the grizzly bear and the wolves have done away with most of all of them now. There's less than 1 million caribou
mm-hmm.
in the hills today.
Mm-hmm.
And there was 10 million. And don't you ever think the wolf is the number one killer and the grizzly bear is the second.
Well, I'm sure that mining out in the hills like the Eagle Summit country and mm-hmm. Ketchum and Deadwood, that mm-hmm. you must have seen a lot of wolves, a lot of bear, and also a lot of caribou as they migrated through
millions
there.
Millions and millions of caribou. Mrs. Reed back there, she saw the big herds of caribou. When a herd of caribou go through, there'd be lots of trails, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be beaten down that deep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just from that one. Well, I can't say how many million caribou I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Rogers was camped on Glacier Creek in the head of the Salt Shore, he and George Dalby. And for 11 days and 11 nights, there were about 30 wide. They come off in the hill like this and cross the valley right in back of their tent and then up over the hill that way. For 11 days and 11 nights that they very seldom slept.
Hmm.
Yeah, they had to sleep through the noise of the hoofs, you know, going through the rocks.
What year was that and what was the location?
That was around 1989.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the location was up in the 40-mile area?
No, the head of the Salt Shore.
Head of the Salt Shore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They calved up there.
I see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about Alaska, we think of bears. Have you ever run across any outstanding specimens?
Yes.
Yeah.
I killed a grizzly on Eagle Creek. I had, in the fall, I shot a moose and I had it hanging up over my trailer, mm-hmm. two-wheel trailer that I'd hook onto and take over to Central. Mm-hmm. And while it was hanging there, we were doing work around there. And by golly, one more, my wife looked out of the window. She said, "There goes a bear." And so I looked, and sure enough, a big grizzly. And he pulled down all that meat on top of him, and it scared him. So he ran across the creek, and I grabbed a rifle, and her son grabbed a rifle, and we ran over there, and we were sneaking around to try to spot him, you know. And we got up within 30 feet of him, and he was just laying there looking right at us, right square in our eye. And then, of course, we pulled down and shot him, mm-hmm. hit him right there, and just blew everything all to pieces. But that was a wounded bear. Yeah, somebody had shot him mm-hmm. with a small caliber rifle right there in the hip, mm-hmm. or in the shoulder,
yeah.
And it stuck in the shoulder blade.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I forget the game warden's name that was at 101 at that time. I kept the hide, and he took and dressed out all of the meat, and he sent it back to the University of California.
Mm-hmm.
They were tickled to death to get the bones.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
The bear was 19 years old.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Was it a record in size? Or
no. About 9.5 or 10 feet. Mm-hmm. I think it was around 9.5 feet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the biggest bear I ever killed was on Turnigan Arm. I killed a big grizzly there. It was 10.5 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. First shot.
I don't think there are too many grizzly left around here, are there?
Lots of grizzly.
Oh, a lot of grizzly?
Lots of grizzly.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. But on Ketchum, or Portage Creek, we were bothered a lot with bears there.
Mm-hmm.
Tore up our cache mm-hmm. several times. And I'll tell you one time, there was a bear tore up our cache and tore the door completely off. And I went out there, and of course he ran away, you know, it was dark.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and went to bed. And by the way, he got away with some chickens and some roast. And a full slab of bacon, and some more. Well, yeah, I brought home a case of peaches to my wife, and these great big peaches, you know. He ate them all and spit the pits out on the floor. So anyway, I see what he'd done, and I went back in and went to bed, and I went sound asleep. My wife woke me up. She said, "I think I heard a noise out there." So I ran out there, and I didn't even have the gun. I looked, and I thought I saw something dark go around the side of the cache, and I tiptoed back into the house and put on my slippers and grabbed the rifle, and as I saw a little spot on the side hill, back of the cache, it was a dark spot. So I couldn't see it, you know, it was just a dark spot there. So I took my rifle and held it up above the hills and put my finger above the barrel that way, and I came down. And when I hit that black spot I let drive, I killed him stone dead. Shot him right through the lungs and heart and everything. Yes, sir. Just lucky. But I have killed as much as 4 bear there that tore up our cache in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
I've killed several black bear there and a few brown bear.
Mm-hmm. There used to be a man by the name of the 40-Mile Kid, and his name was Carson. Could you be the same man?
No. His name started with a K.
Yeah.
I knew him real well.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Harry Carstein.
Harry Carstein. Mm-hmm. And I believe there was a Carson that climbed Mount McKinley, the
that
pioneer.
That was the man.
Oh, that was the
that
man.
That was the man. That's
same
right.
Man, I
he
see.
He had his widow out to find her home.
Now?
Reese Carson's to find her home.
Oh, how interesting.
He's talking about those caribou on the hill out there. 1924-25, I've seen the hill just moving out there. You look and it looks like just a wave on the hill, and it's a curve
that's right.
Going across there. Mm-hmm.
Everywhere you look, it's just a steady move. That's right.
It just looks in, it's just like the hill, you know, like a breeze going through. You think it was trees or something, there's no trees there. And when they come down, then they come across the road, and it's just
the last big herd I saw up on Eagle Summit was in 44. That was the last big herd I ever saw. From then on, it's all there may be 100,000 or 200,000 caribou or something like that. But that's just a drop in the bucket.
I think that's 240 slides, and some of them crossing. I think 500 slides for the caribou for crossing.
You've ever been over across the mountains there?
No, I never did much climbing across the mountains.
They have what they call the Porcupine Bluffs there, and they're very steep, and the caribou, they go zigzag that way, and switchback.
I
bet those trails, how's that?
Up around 12 Mile or Eagle Summit?
No, that's on the other side of Eagle, on Porcupine, Porcupine Bluffs.
Go too far, only across the valley and up the hill from the road, you know, down the valley and up.
But today, those hills are just even. There's no more trails there. Not any more trails at all.
It's all grown up.
He wants to know if the wolves killed them off.
Well, the wolves have killed most of them. I'll say that. One trip I went over in the Salcha, the caribou run was on, and just where I walked, I counted 11 big fat caribou, and some of them not a bite taken out of them. They'd rip the stomach open and then go back and watch them crump their insides out and die. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'd like to ask you a couple more questions.
Yep.
Now, you're one of the gentlemen that has made history here in Alaska. You're one of the prospectors that had a lot of persistence and have been successful, not
That's
once
right.
but three times.
That's right.
So you're one of the men who have made a success of it. Now, surely you met many other men during your lifetime up here,
yes.
A few of them. Could you tell us about some of the other pioneers that you were associated with in the mining game?
Gus Hegg, he was a miner on Caribou Creek. Mm-hmm. He was a successful miner, and there's Ed Owens and Charlie Lockhart on No Grub. They had awful good ground.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Lockhart, he found a creek up in there where I found that one that I ran off and left.
Mm-hmm.
He found a creek there too, where he shoveled in $500 one summer, old price of gold.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And there's many other Fairbanksons here that's pretty successful too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, of course Fairbanks, after it was drilled and the likes of that. There was no ifs or ands about
mm-hmm.
it, you know. They'd
mm-hmm.
sink a hole and you know where your pay was.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to get out and dig like
mm-hmm.
I did. I got into a shallow country, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I sunk 16 holes, my wife and I sunk 16 holes one winter with wood fires. No boiler, just with wood fires alone. And we rocked all of the dirt. When we hit the pay, or hit the little money, why, we rocked the dirt. So we had all of those samples that winter.
Mm-hmm.
And we gathered our own wood, too.
Mm.
Yeah.
We got a rocker down here somewhere. Maybe we have a rocker here. Back in someplace here.
I believe I see it down there, yeah.
Yeah, we have
uh-huh.
a rocker here. I
now,
can take
yeah. yeah.
Mr. Carson, if you have anything else you would like to tell us, I'm sure that some of the people in our audience would like to ask you some questions.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll tell you about Frank Miller.
Yes, we'd like to hear about him.
I'm supposed to tell you about Frank Miller.
Yes, we want to hear about him.
I knew Cal Miller in in the fall, I'll say August of 34. No, August of 33. I met Cal Miller for the first time. But I heard a lot about Cal Miller. He came to Dawson in 98 with a herd of cattle. He drove him one over. And then in 1909 or 1910, he drove a bunch of cattle from Valdez to Fairbanks. And they were all around 2 year old. But They say when you got into Fairbanks, there was all so skinny that, and the meat was just black. But I talked with a man this afternoon that helped a cow miller butcher all of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and he's in the hospital now. Who? Charlie Kramer.
Oh, Charlie, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Wilbur Jewell, he's another old timer. Mm-hmm. He's in the same room.
Now, Wilbur Jewell was a, he ran a mail route or something like that.
Yeah, Jewell and O'Leary. Mm-hmm. They ran to, over the circle.
I see. Well, tell us more about Frank.
You know, Frank Miller, he bought the Miller house in 35 or 36.
Who did he buy it from?
He bought it from Jay Kelly.
And who had it before Kelly?
Well, that I don't know. I don't know. I know who built the Miller house in 92. A man by the name of Miller built the bunk house in 92. And Casper Ellingen and Miller built the roadhouse in 93 then.
I see.
Mm-hmm. I knew Casper Ellingen real well.
Yes.
And Frank Miller, he and Mrs. Miller, they bought the roadhouse. Well, they bought Miller House in 35, I believe it was 35 or 36.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Jay Kelly sold it and to his daughter and son-in-law, Madeline and Bob Wilkinson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they ran it for a couple of years. And then Frank Miller bought it.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew Mrs. Miller in the fall of 23. She, her name was, I don't know what her name was. She wasn't married then. But she had gotten a divorce. She was married to Roy Lund in the spring of 23. And then she got a divorce that summer.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Miller finally bought the Cassiar Roadhouse, which is on the Steese Highway, mile 55,
mm-hmm.
right down the hill.
Mm-hmm.
She bought that, and she ran that, and Frank Miller went prospecting up on Faith, Hope, and Charity, and Sam Moe and another fellow, I don't know his name,
mm-hmm.
and Frank Miller. They all three were prospecting on Faith, Hope, and Charity. And about once a week, Frank Miller would run down to Cassiar Roadhouse and then go back. So that's about
did
all
you know,
I
Mrs. Were you ever at Liban Good? Did you ever prospect in that country?
No.
She used to have a roadhouse there at one particular time or a restaurant.
Yes, she did. She took in washings there too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm wondering if you have something else you want to tell us about Miller.
No, I've done told you about Frank Miller and my experience with him.
It's on the left bank, isn't it? The limit.
Of Eagle Creek?
Of Eagle Creek.
It's on the right limit.
Oh, right limit.
Yeah. I hope all of you people can come up there. I'll show you some gold.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you wanted to hear about my dog, was it?
Yes.
Well, I think I owned the smartest dog that was ever in Alaska. And one of the nicest dogs. He weighed 150 pounds and when he was in his prime. He was a Mackenzie River Husky. And I'd talk to him just like he was a human being. And he'd understand me. I'd tell him to go get the shovel. He'd go down and he'd get the shovel. A pick or a gold pan or anything at all. He never made a mistake. Never. And he could, at home, Andy Bergeson and his wife used to come up and visit us, and Boots was outside. Why, he would open the door, and he'd open it, walk in, reach up with his paw, and he'd close it, kawhammo, it'd go. And they'd look, you know, surprised, you know. And the old Boots, he'd walk in just as unconcerned and sit down alongside of my wife. Just like that. Just a wonderful dog. And at one time there was a man come over to Central in an airplane. He wanted to see me. And I was 2 miles back. There was a stand of Polewood back there. And I cranked up the little six cap that morning and I went back there and was cutting this Polewood. And old Boots, he would deliver messages, you see. So my wife said, well, if you want to see Hein, I'll get him. So I was 2 miles back, now mind you. And that dog, she had wrote a note and gave it to him, and he brought it out there. And I was just chopping down a tree, and as I went to chop, here was Boots. So I saw the note, and I read it, and I folded it different, so to let her know he was there. And he took the note and took it back home. Of course, I came home.
Well, one that reason you're successful is mining game, you got cheap labor.
I found out that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I found out you had to have cheap labor.
Yeah. I was interested in no grub. 1924, when your sister and the Saunders were mining there.
Oh,
remember,
yeah.
The Saunders and your sister Mary Prager?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And she had five or six of us come over there for dinner one day. Mm-hmm. And one of the early day aviators, Herman Lerdahl.
I know him.
Uh-huh. I knew her there then. I met her then.
Mm-hmm. I remember Herman Lerdahl. How's that?
It was 1924.
1924.
There we
mm-hmm.
are.
Yeah.
I think there was some landing light, a little narrow strip on the bar, and a lady in those old bush tops that fly, he flew around, you know, and he'd buzz them to let them know we were coming, and they'd have to row a boat across this little stream there. You remember that? They rowed the boat. They had to row a boat across the stream to get to the airplane.
Uh-huh.
And he would circle around, you know, and buzz the cabin so they'd know we were coming, and then. Why, we scared to death because we were just barely hitting the top of the trees, you know, and coming down through there and to land on that little narrow ribbon of sandbar. How he did it, I don't know. I was scared to death to start back home again. But he was a wonderful pilot, that Herman.
Yes, you bet. I made 18 trips with the poling boat up to Salcha.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Now that's something you can tell us about. How in the dickens did you ever make any headway? What speed did you make with the poling boat?
Well, I left Salcha one night at 4 o'clock, and I pulled all night, and at 9 o'clock the next morning I was 78 miles up to Salcha.
Now, how large was your boat?
I had a 22-foot boat at that time.
22-foot.
But my best poling was with a 30-foot boat. Mm-hmm. It belonged to Gus Hegg. Mm-hmm. He had a nice boat.
Well, how do you keep that pole from sticking in the mud and so forth as you go up?
Well,
or does it?
No, it doesn't stick in the mud. I could pull both ways, pull that way, or I could pull this way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You would bring the pole up and then slam it down according to the depth of the water, you know. I liked about 5-6 feet of water, and that was pretty nice to pole in.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was deeper, it was a little bit hard on account of holding it.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And you get so used to it, you bring your pole kind of under your boat, and it's sharp on both ends, and it's 30 feet long, and you bring your pole kind of, the flare is about like that, and you bring it under the boat, and you can hold your boat right there. Yeah.
Well, I learned something.
Yes, sir. You can hold your boat right up against any kind of current.
You're just pulling yourself along that pole.
That's right.
That's right.
You bring it up and bring it down, and you come that way, and then you bring it up and then down.
And the pole is about 30 feet long.
No, about 24 feet.
I see.
Is about the limit.
Oh, when you talk about a 22-foot poling boat, you're talking about the pole and not the length of the boat.
Yeah, I was talking about the length of the boat.
Boat and the pole.
The pole is around 22-24 feet.
I see.
And the boat that I had was 22 feet long.
I see.
But the best boat I ever poled was Gus Hegg's. Mm-hmm. It was a 30-foot poling boat.
I see.
One he built himself, whoopsawed the lumber.
Mm-hmm. And did you have a load aboard it when you went upstream?
Oh, yeah. I had 1,380 pounds. I never will forget it. I had 1,380 pounds when I went up there with the 22-foot boat.
He made 78 miles in
4 o'clock in the evening when I left, and at 9 o'clock the next morning I was at No Grub. Old Tom Gilmore. You all heard of Tom Gilmore. Old Tom Gilmore was at the cabin.
I'm wondering if any of you have any questions you'd like to ask Mr. Carson.
I wonder if you ever packed Boots. How many pounds would he carry as a pack dog?
You wonder how many pounds I would pack?
No, the dog, Boots.
Oh, the
dog.
Boots, he'd go along with 50 pounds on his back all day long. I have pictures of him.
You had 50 pounds, and he had 50 pounds, and you had a quarter of moose. Huh? Yeah.
Yeah, he'd go all day long with 50 pounds. Mm-hmm. Peggy?
She wanted to know if the poling boats had a rudder in the back.
No. It was just straight that way. And you did all of the steering with this pole. You would hold it underneath as you go ahead with it. It would run under. It's kind of the lost art nowadays, I notice.
We don't have the men anymore.
No,
that's a problem.
Right. That's right. That's right.
I'd like to have Randy tell about the time that when he first came to Fairbanks and his whole outfit was burned out in the fire at the North Hill Hotel. How he had to get started all over again.
Randy, tell us about when you were burned out of the Nordale Hotel.
I landed in Fairbanks on the 26th of March in the evening, about 5 o'clock in the evening. And the next day I walked around town and everybody seemed so different, you know. Good morning, and nice morning this morning. Men I never dreamed was on earth. And that afternoon I wrote to my mother and I said, I believe I've moved in with the largest family in the world. That's what I said to my mother. And I still say that, but they're a lot different nowadays. Mm-hmm. But the old timers are pretty nice yet. But I went to... Anyway, Jimmy Stewart and Paul Dinhart, they've shipped in a steam shovel. It's the one that's on Alaska land here now, mm-hmm. That three-quarter yard. That's the shovel I operated on the 23. Yeah. And I help assemble the machine. And it was 20... about the 28th when I got this job. And the first day of April, I was helping them load over at the depot. Everything was in crates, you know. And I was helping them load these crates and stuff. I thought I saw smoke. The Nordale was on First Avenue there. And I looked and looked. It was smoke. I was started right out and run over there, but the thing blew up like that. The top blew right out of the top of the Nordale. I lost everything I had but the clothes on my back, and I had another fellow with me that I paid for his way up, most of his way up, and I bought all of his clothes, and everything went up in smoke. So we went to the NC then and bought another outfit and took it up to Salcher with us. So that was my first experience in Alaska. Mm-hmm. On the first day of April.
1923, yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the narrow gauge railroad? You had a change at Nenana and you went on the Tandaw Railroad.
Yeah,
can you tell us a little bit about us?
I just had that one ride on the narrow gauge, mm-hmm. from Nenana to Fairbanks, mm-hmm. and that summer Harding came up and drove the Golden Spike, mm-hmm. because they widened the road, you see. Mm-hmm. So I don't know much about that. But that fall, I took a ride out to Chattanooga, yeah. on the narrow gauge that went out there. Mm-hmm. I took a ride out on the narrow gauge just to say I rode out there.
I see. Mm-hmm.
That Golden used to be right across from the mouth of Gilmore Creek. Mm-hmm. And it used to be a little town there. It even had a bank there. Golden was the name of it. And that's where the train turned around and went back and went up Fox Gulch.
It seems that you know the name of every tributary and every creek in Alaska.
No.
Nearly all of them.
No. That part of the country, yes, I do.
I see.
I know that part of the country. The geologists and a lot of Washington people come there to my house and got the names of the creeks and the cabins and everything right where they're located. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the names on the map are named after me. That is, I told them what the names of the pigs
mm-hmm.
were.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them.
Well,
yeah.
How long did your dog live?
How long
did your dog live?
Oh, he was born on the 29th day of November, and he died on the 21st day of October, and he would have been 16 years old. Mm-hmm. Question? Question?
Now that's a very good question. You have an extremely good memory, and obviously you're approaching 80 apparently, and you're still mining, and mining is the hardest business there is, and you're still going strong. Mm-hmm. I notice you have your own natural teeth. Apparently you have perfect teeth.
They're kind of snaggled, but I still have my teeth.
What's that, from sampling gold?
No, I had a lot of gold in my face, and it eventually went out.
Oh,
as long as I can chew with my own teeth, I think I'll use them.
Well, but you have a good memory, and you're apparently in very good health, and you owe this to having selected your parents carefully, or...
How's that?
Do you attribute that to having selected your parents carefully, or possibly...
Mostly,
I see.
As I say, when Dad got drowned, I built a gymnasium of my own, mm-hmm. all homemade, and I did an awful, awful lot of exercising, morning and night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She says you had trouble with your back.
Oh, yes. I had a disc removed out of my spine.
Mm-hmm.
I was down on Turning an Iron, and I was loading ties, and my brother-in-law was helping me load them, and I had two wagons. And he was a kind of a fellow that didn't care much about work, and he'd pick a rune, and he'd let it fall into a tie and drag it up. But this time it happened to be a big, heavy tie, and it was raining, I was wet, and it fell back down, and I got mad, and I picked the tie up, and I threw it up on top of the load. Well, I landed back the other way. So for 14 years, I had a bad back. But Doc Hegland operated on my back, and I have a wonderful back now. I can pan for a half a day, just one pan right after another, never bothered me. And never stoop over, I pan like, oh, my knees. I pan like that, and straighten up, and then down, and it never bothered me at all. I have a wonderful back.
Yes, tell us about your mother.
My mother?
Mm-hmm.
Well, she was a German lady.
Yes.
She was, I could hold my arm out and she could walk under.
Mm.
And she was 45 years old when my dad got drowned.
Mm-hmm.
And she never married.
Mm-hmm.
Never married. And raised a family. And she took in Washington, too.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And that was at Leavenworth, Washington.
Leavenworth, mm-hmm. Washington, yes.
And how long did she live? She lived to be an old lady?
She lived to be 83 years old.
83, mm-hmm. I see.
I remember she died on the 25th of June when she was 83.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Question?
Are any of your brothers and sisters followed you to Alaska?
Any of your brothers and sisters follow you to Alaska?
Well, I had two brothers come up here, just up and back, and they didn't stay. Not that they didn't like it, but they were both married, you know, and they just come up. In fact, I have a brother that's going to come up here this summer.
Uh-huh.
He's in a wheelchair, though. He had infantile paralysis when he was 33 years old, and he learned the cabinet work, and he made his money by cabinet work for the government,
mm-hmm.
at Pilot Rock, Oregon.
When did your sister come in? When did Mary come in, your sister? When did your sister come here?
Oh,
my sister Mary came up here on the 25th of June, 1925. Yeah, 1925 when she came. And I think she went back in 28 or 29, somewhere along in there when she went back outside. But they're all gone now. Craiger's gone, and Craiger.
Margaret's his wife?
Huh?
Margaret's his wife? Margaret?
Margaret, she's living in Kennewick, Washington. Uh-huh. That's the daughter.
I worked with Mary in 1920 at American Hand Laundry.
A very good question. The gentleman asks, what are you planning to do in the future?
Well, it's hard to say, but I always tell people I'm going to live to be 100. And I'm going to mine on Lower Eagle unless the Bureau of Land Management or the Fish and Wildlife close me down. I'm having a little trouble with them now. Because they claim I pollute the water, but I claim I'm not. But that'll be settled before I go back on Eagle. But I'll mine on Eagle for a long, long time, I believe. I'd put it up to the Fish and Wildlife.